WMAL News at 7. Good morning, I'm Heather Curtis. About 100 people are arrested at Brooklyn Center in Minnesota last night as crowds broke through barricades around the police department protesting the fatal police shooting of a 20-year-old Dante Wright. Hennepin County Sheriff David Hutchinson speaking early this morning.
We're not talking about Mr. Wright anymore. We're talking about people who are intent of causing harm to further their agenda, not for a young man who was killed, to further their agenda of their whatever agenda they have.
The cop who pulled the trigger and fired the fatal shot, Kim Potter, is charged with second-degree manslaughter. The Biden administration hit with criticism from Democrats who want the U.S. to let in more refugees.
Presidential determination on refugee admissions for fiscal year 2021 appeared to leave intact the Trump administration's refugee cap at 15,000, significantly less than Biden's campaign promise to reverse the cap and allow more than 60,000 this year alone. That brought on an avalanche of protests from his own party. The White House issued a clarification, acknowledging that the administration's initial goal of settling 62,500 refugees this year was too ambitious and seemed, quote, unlikely.
Fox's Kevin Cork. If you're behind on your rent in Montgomery County, you may be able to get some help from the county. Executive Mark Elrich.
This is $59 million of emergency rental assistance. $31 million is direct to the county from the Treasury, and $28 million was passed through to us from the Treasury to the state of Maryland and then to this county.
If you aren't getting paid as much or lost your job because of the pandemic, you may qualify for up to 12 grand or 15 months of payments. A New Jersey man's hospitalized with COVID after getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
The daughter of 52-year-old Francisco Cosme telling the New York Post her father's condition has worsened. Cosme got the virus despite getting the J&J shot 5 weeks ago. Michelle Torres saw her father briefly Friday in a FaceTime call but says he's unconscious. She says the doctors say right now it's still up to his body to keep going. The CDC has asked for a pause in giving out the J&J vaccine while they investigate cases of blood clots that may be linked to it. Chris DeMeo, Fox News.
We've all seen the World War II memorial on the National Mall. Now you can see a new memorial at Pershing Park to honor the 4.7 million Americans who fought in World War I, including more than 116,000 who died. Architect Joe Weishar.
The park was already named for General Pershing, who was the commander of all the troops in World War I.
The memorial's not done yet. In 2024, a wall will be installed that depicts a soldier's journey during the war. WMAL Sports, the Nats beat Arizona 1-0. Matt Scherzer recorded his 2,807th career strikeout, passing Cy Young for 22nd on baseball's career strikeouts list. That series with the Diamondbacks continues today at 1:05. The Wizards beat the Pelicans 117-115. They'll play the Pistons tonight at 8. Traffic and weather next. WMAL traffic, here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
In D.C. on 295 westbound, there is construction with only one lane open between the 3rd Street Tunnel and South Capitol Street. Now the traffic is jammed back to the 3rd Street Tunnel. In Bethesda on 270 Spur northbound, disabled vehicle left lane is blocked after Democracy Boulevard. In College Park on Cherry Hill Road southbound, there's construction. Both right turn lanes are closed at Route 1. And in Fairfax County on 66 westbound, the Fair Oaks exit, exit 57, the on-ramp is closed. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clouds will be on the increase as we move through the afternoon hours across the DMV with daytime high temperatures ranging from 60 to 65 degrees. For the overnight, mostly cloudy skies. Temperatures drop down to the 40s. Winds will be out of the northwest. Tomorrow, partly cloudy. Can't rule out a chance for a few stray showers, mainly during the late afternoon hours and into the evening. Not all neighborhoods will get wet. We'll see temperatures in the 60s to lower 70s by Tuesday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
Now, the Saturday morning update.
105.9 FM, WMAL.
It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. It's hour two. John Gizzi joins us. He's the White House correspondent and chief political columnist at Newsmax.com and Newsmax TV. John, good morning.
Good morning to you, Rick.
President Biden now having issues with Russia, the expulsion of 10 diplomats on both sides of the Atlantic, and other sanctions being taken by both countries. Give us a summary of where you see President Biden with Russia these days and how he is handling the relations with Putin.
Well, the relations are very, very bad. And it seems with each passing day, they get very, very worse. From President Biden calling President Putin a killer to the dispute over Ukraine and the president stressing the United States' firm commitment to President Zelensky of Ukraine and that embattled country, and most recently to the plight of political prisoners, notably Alexei Navalny, now on a hunger strike in Russia's notorious IK2 prison. President Biden on Tuesday had a conversation with the man in the Kremlin, and he stressed our commitment to Ukraine as well as to not having interference in U.S. elections. Conspicuous by its absence was the plight of Alexei Navalny. Mr. Navalny, of course, was someone who nearly died from poisoning and went to a German hospital against the advice of his closest intimates. He came back to Moscow, was promptly arrested, and sentenced to do the remainder of a prison term he'd received before. Now he's on a hunger strike, and even his own doctors cannot get in to see him. This would have been natural for President Biden to bring up, as the whole world is watching. And the person who brought it to the attention of Newsmax was none other than Mikhail Khodorkovsky, perhaps the most famous Russian exile and opponent to Putin in the world. He was once the richest man in Russia. He broke with Putin and for his troubles had 10 years in prison. Now he lives in London, and he said, making no mistake about what he meant, that the health and indeed the lives of Russian political prisoners must be the focus of world leaders everywhere. And he would just hope that attention on this situation would be a priority not only of Mr. Biden, in his words, but Mrs. Merkel and Mr. Macron.
There have been stories about former President Trump taking on some senatorial and congressional candidates in 2022, among them Liz Cheney and Lisa Murkowski. And you're hearing developments this week?
Major developments. Earlier in the week, the president called the Wyoming congresswoman at large, Crazy Liz, and called for her defeat. He said that the problem is that there are more than one primary opponents to the four-termer, and they should unite behind one candidate. He said he would have an endorsement for someone soon. Now, I might add that this came just as Liz Cheney told Fox News' Neil Cavuto without hesitation that she would not support Donald Trump if he's the Republican nominee for president in 2024. She also said that the gravest violation of a president's oath was his encouragement of the mob on January 6th. So it's no surprise that President Trump is going after Congresswoman Cheney and is going to make this a high priority of his. He may even become the broker of the conservative opponents to Ms. Cheney to get behind one candidate. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska is rumored to be considering retirement. Now, I spoke yesterday to a prominent fundraiser for the National Republican Senate Committee who said she's definitely running. She told reporters she hasn't made up her mind. Whatever the situation, she's been in the Senate nearly 20 years. I remember reporting how she got into the Senate. Her dad was elected governor and then promptly appointed her to his Senate seat. It was controversial, but she's managed to survive and is now considering a bid for a fourth full term next year. She faces a primary from Kelly Shibaka, former state commissioner of administration in Alaska, Harvard Law graduate, and mother of five. Most importantly, Ms. Shibaka is almost sure to be the candidate of Donald Trump and already his former campaign manager, Bill Stepien, is in her corner.
One question on Liz Cheney. Obviously a personality conflict between she and the former president. How do you sense the Wyoming voters feel about the stand she's taking against President Trump?
Okay. President Trump carried Wyoming with more than 60% of the vote. It was a landslide for him in the Cowboy State. And Republican activists at their county committee meetings are voting increasingly to censure their congresswoman. I might add that I spoke to a Republican activist just last night who said that she is no longer going to party meetings because it's going to get abusive and loud. So clearly there is a base to oppose her. That said, Liz Cheney has raised a record $1.5 million to seek re-election. Former House Speaker Paul Ryan recently hosted a fundraising party for her. So she's going to be well-armed going into the battle royal.
John, somewhat of an unprecedented press conference in front of the Supreme Court held by progressives who clearly want to pack the Supreme Court, recommending that they add four justices to the Supreme Court. Your thoughts about that in terms of a historical perspective, and then secondly, just the entire impact of the progressives on President Biden now.
Democrats who read history, and I include Speaker Pelosi in that group, are well aware that FDR's first major political stumble was in 1937, when, after reelected by carrying all but two states, Maine and Vermont, and having two-thirds majorities in the House and Senate, decided to enlarge the Supreme Court and thought that he could do so with ease. Well, members of both political parties said no. They called it court packing and a dictator bill, and within short order, the measure was defeated. Since then, students of history, students of the law, and even the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that it was never intended to have a Supreme Court that is enlarged to go along with political trends or the whim of a president. I might add that the only time court packing succeeded and the jurists went above the nine was during the first term of Abraham Lincoln, when they were able to enlarge it to 10. But then a justice died, and Lincoln appointed the brother of his one-time law partner, Stephen Field, and they left it at 9. It's an area that people don't go to, and when even Nancy Pelosi tells the left not to go there, you know that this is a non-starter.
There were a lot of questions as to whether the president would conduct a State of the Union address, but he's going to do something similar?
He's going to address a joint session of Congress, and one thing I would caution our listeners today, do not expect that crowded House chamber that is so familiar when the clerk calls out, Mr. Speaker or Madam Speaker, the President of the United States. Because of social distancing and the rules we're still observing with COVID, there's going to be space between members, and many have voluntarily decided to stay in their office or at home and watch on television. It'll be a very different kind of address. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki cautioned me not to use the term State of the Union. It's an address to a joint session, and it will cover where the United States is, particularly in the grappling of the COVID virus. One more thing. This is the longest any president has gone in his first year in office before going before a joint session of Congress, no matter what you call it. The lone exception was Richard Nixon, who did not give an address at all in 1969 because of his predecessor, Lyndon Johnson, gave a farewell / State of the Union message in January, and he did not want to compete with him or be perceived that way.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. As always, John, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, and I'm speaking to you 48 hours after I was vaccinated for the second time for COVID-19. If you have the chance to do this, do it as soon as possible, and keep wearing that mask just a little longer. This is going to be over soon. Please do our part.
Thank you, John. Good words. 7:18, Saturday Morning Update, WMAL. Cheryl Atkinson coming up next, but first we'll head over to the WMAL Traffic Center. LBD is there this morning.
In Prince George's County on Cherry Hill Road, southbound at College Park, there is construction. Both right turn lanes are closed at Route 1. In Bethesda on 270 Spur, northbound, there is a disabled vehicle. Left lane is blocked at Democracy Boulevard. In Fairfax County on 66 westbound, the Fair Oaks exit, exit 57, the on-ramp is closed. And on the westbound side of 695 in D.C., there is construction. Only one lane is open between the 3rd Street Tunnel and South Capitol Street. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clouds will be on the increase as we move through the afternoon hours across the DMV, with daytime high temperatures ranging from 60 to 65 degrees. For the overnight, mostly cloudy skies. Temperatures drop down to the 40s. Winds will be out of the northwest. Tomorrow, partly cloudy. Can't rule out a chance for a few stray showers, mainly during the late afternoon hours and into the evening. Not all neighborhoods will get wet. We'll see temperatures in the 60s to lower 70s by Tuesday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
39 degrees at 7:20 in the nation's capital on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday Morning Update. We're glad that you've joined us this weekend. Cheryl Atkinson is with us. She is the host of Full Measure. That's tomorrow morning on ABC 7 at 10 o'clock. She's also the author of Slanted, How the News Media Taught Us to Love Censorship and Hate Journalism. Cheryl, good morning.
Good morning.
Lot of debate these days about defunding the police. Of course, the tweet earlier in the week from Congressman Rashida Tlaib, where she was talking about the incident in Minneapolis. She said, it wasn't an accident. Policing in our country is inherently and intentionally racist. Dante Wright was met with aggression and violence. I am done with those who condone government-funded murder. No more policing, incarceration, and militarization. It can't be reformed. You have a story where you actually look into communities where there have been efforts to defund the police. And what are you finding?
You know, it's been said in some of these communities that the people who get hurt the most when the police are challenged and defunded and so on are the communities that really need them the most, often minority and African-American neighborhoods. And Scott Thuman went back to Minneapolis, where he was last summer measuring the story for us, and he found, you know, it's much the same. He spoke to an African-American community activist who talks about this huge spike in crime they've had since all of these controversies and since they've cut the budget for the police. And the citizens in Minnesota are actually suing the city to try to get 100 more cops, even as the city is talking about disbanding the police force altogether. And their claim is that under the city charter, you have to have a certain number of police per capita there per person who lives there. And they're 100 short because no one wants to police there. They're having a hard time getting people. The cops are retiring and they're taking long-term leave. So it's a mess, and the spike in crime is phenomenal. And Scott Thuman found that's the case in many cities that have moved money from the budget. You know, in Los Angeles, they've transferred something like $150 million out of the police budget, and they've done much the same, I think the same amount in Austin. And all of these places are having really big spikes in crime and homicides.
We hear their narrative from the community leaders and the politicians, but what do you hear from the, quote-unquote, the silent majority or the business community or those citizens who don't have the voice? They're not politicians. They don't have the media attention. What do you hear from them after several months of these defunding efforts?
Well, Scott found, and I think polls reflect the same pretty much wherever you look, that the majority of people don't want to do this. I'm calling it sort of today's tyranny by the minority viewpoint, because most people don't want to defund the police. I think most people think most police departments do not have any sort of systemic racism, that there are pockets of problems, and certainly in some of the larger city police departments, we know there are big issues. But to sweepingly say that police agencies are murdering people in the streets and need to be disbanded, Most Americans think that talk is radical and far outside the norm of where they are on this position.
You mentioned police retiring, and there's talk of recruiting issues that they're now having with the police officers. What are you finding in terms of the police morale?
Well, it's bad, and we covered that on Full Measure probably in the last 9 months or so, where police agencies are having to come up with all kinds of creative incentives to try to attract people and pay them more in some cases. But the problem is, critics say they're having to accept people who are less qualified, candidates who maybe wouldn't have been hired in a different environment 5 or 6 years ago, but now they have to look at these people and consider them because the pool is not as good as it used to be. So if you look at kind of the unintended consequences, I know some people really think that police agencies need to be reformed and changed, but kind of by throwing the baby out with the bathwater in some instances, the community activists say they're making matters worse for the very people they're trying to help.
Many lingering questions as to why things got out of hand at the Capitol on January 6th, and many people asking questions, but the answers haven't really been forthcoming. You're looking for answers on Sunday.
Well, it's a little weird because, you know, the FBI moved very quickly and efficiently, unlike with the riots last summer, to identify hundreds of people and arrest them and be very aggressive with this. But not so much in turning over information and details that gets at the heart of how this all got out of control. This is the sort of situation you would think Capitol Police are trained to handle, rather routinely trained to handle, in fact, because this is always a potential threat or seen as a potential threat at the Capitol. There could be people trying to break in. So what really happened? Well, the Inspector General came out with some really scathing findings in the past couple of days that show the Capitol Police were not well prepared. They had faulty equipment. They didn't share intelligence. But Senator Ron Johnson, Republican on the Homeland Security Committee, he's been really asking some interesting questions that could get at the heart of how all of this was allowed to happen. And he says he hasn't been getting a lot of the answers. You know, not everybody's been forthcoming. So he's continuing to pursue that. He's not going to stop trying to figure out where some of these lapses were, and maybe specifically who made the call when it came to not being properly prepared.
Both of those stories in depth tomorrow on Full Measure, 10 o'clock on ABC7. Cheryl, as always, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Rick.
7:26, KT McFarland and Tony Schaefer on the way.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. Now, more than ever, depend on 105.9 FM, WMAL, a Cumulus station. News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning, I'm Heather Curtis. We're learning more about the teenager who opened fire at a FedEx facility, killing 8 people. Fox's Jeff Paul reports the 19-year-old was questioned by the FBI last year.
That's after his mother told police she feared that the 19-year-old might commit, quote, suicide by cop. They took a shotgun away from him, but he was not charged. Authorities say the former FedEx employee took his own life after the shooting rampage on Thursday night.
The victims were between the ages of 19 and 74. That mass shooting and others recently have President Joe Biden urging Congress to take action and pass gun control legislation that may be difficult with Biden's robust agenda and a narrow Democratic majority. Still, Biden says he's never not prioritized gun control. Montgomery County is offering $59 million from the feds to residents behind on their rent because of pandemic-induced income losses.
They have to certify that their income is under a certain amount. They have to certify that the lost income was due to COVID-19.
County Executive Mark Elrich says you also have to be at least $1,000 behind on rent. WMAL Sports, the Nats beat Arizona 1-0. Max Scherzer recorded his 2,807th career strikeout, passing Cy Young for 22nd on baseball's career strikeouts list. And the Wizards beat the Pelicans 117-115. Traffic and weather next on WMAL. WMAL traffic, here's LBD in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
The Maryland side of the Beltway right now this morning, you can go from bridge to bridge, Prince George's County through Montgomery County on the inner loop and the outer loop without tapping the brakes. In Bethesda on 270, the spur northbound, there is a disabled vehicle. Left lane is blocked after Democracy Boulevard. in D.C. on 295 westbound. Road construction with only one lane open between the 3rd Street Tunnel and the South Capitol Street exit. Traffic is jammed back to the 3rd Street Tunnel. And in Fairfax on 66 westbound at the Fair Oaks exit, exit 57, that on-ramp is closed. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Clouds will be on the increase moving through the midday hours. We'll see mostly cloudy skies by late afternoon. High temperatures range from the lower to middle 60s. For tonight, mostly cloudy and chilly, dropping out of the 40s by early tomorrow morning. Tomorrow, partly cloudy. A stray shower or two cannot be ruled out, especially late in the day and into the evening hours. Temperatures near 65 degrees. Lingering showers on Monday. Daytime highs near 70 on Tuesday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
7:36, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer joins us every week. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research and the author of Operation Dark Heart. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Great to join you.
Well, I know during the election season we talked to you about election security, and I know you've been instrumental in consulting with various states and entities on election security. You were in Pennsylvania this past week in front of the General Assembly, and I wanted to talk to you about what your testimony included. Now, this is not political. This is more sort of on the technical and the security side. We're not talking about the politics or the court cases or any of that. This is technical stuff that I guess not only applicable in Pennsylvania, but could be any state in the union.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, the legislature was actually working to review the entire set of issues. This was one of a number of hearings that they've been running. And what's interesting, Rick, is that, yeah, my testimony was, I think, very nonpartisan. With that said, other parts of the hearing were very partisan, and I was not in those. But I was asked by the House State Government Committee to provide an assessment of what needed to be done to fix their election from the threat issue. What can be learned from how a foreign or other threat and I would actually categorize hacking organizations, which they may not be affiliated with any government, as part of those threats. What did they learn, or what can they learn and take away from what we observed that happened during the November 2020 election? And so I went through and did an evaluation of how I would do it if I were a bad guy, if I were a foreign intelligence officer looking to upend or create chaos next time. And there was a great deal of opportunity. Any observed weakness within the system, and some of those were very well documented in Pennsylvania regarding the actual machines which you have to transfer data from and to, the thumb drives moving between machines, the issues relating to what people observed being essentially not within spec or within regulation. If those violations are observed, then you can have a foreign threat do things to modify or otherwise get into the machines via these vectors. So that's one of the most important things. Secondly, to your point, yeah, this is I've actually testified in front of Texas, Georgia, South Carolina. I've had conversations with Rick DeSantis and his staff on this. This has been an issue that some states got more correct than others, and I look at this, and I made this mention in my written testimony, I look at this differently than the other folks. I'm not here to judge who gains advantage regarding voting, how they vote by mail. You know, as I said in my it doesn't really matter to me. You've got to follow your rules, and you've got to examine how to establish security oversight, which then secures your process, because if you don't secure the process for domestic reasons, foreign entities will target you and take advantage. We know that. And they'll throw a lot of money into this. So I walk through this in, I think, a very logical, factual way. And I didn't end up getting attacked by the Democrats, but others did during that session. So, I thought it was a very useful hearing.
You mentioned flash drives in there, and, yeah. and I got a little skittish during the election season when I heard about flash drives, especially obviously yeah. when they were counting votes and things.
Of course, yes.
What are the vulnerabilities of flash drives and the people who may have control of them, whether they are Republican or Democrat?
Well, that's exactly the issue. It's one of those situations where no matter how good your technology is, the weakness is the individuals using technology. Technology is completely ambivalent to the user. And if you have people who are not trustworthy, they will automatically compromise that technology, the security mechanisms in that technology. And several folks, I've interviewed a number, Greg Sindstrom, former Navy officer, observed what he believed to be, you know, less than adequate supply security chain of custody issues. And trust me, if you have this out there and foreign entities think they can get a thumb drive into the mix that is compromised, it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. So this is where, again, technology is ambivalent to parties, as is its use. So you've got to actually look at how you would want to protect this from someone outside the country. Because if this happens, either side may find itself having opened the door if they conducted any sort of shenanigans with the bad guys being able to upend the results of an election, which nobody wants.
In all of the work you've done, do you get a sense that there are enough observers on either side, you know, whether they are Republican or Democratic, are there enough observers or do they need more observers?
I think that's an excellent question, and I don't have the answer because this last cycle there were observers denied access. So you can't really judge that if you don't allow the ones to do their job that were in there. And that is something that, again, I hit on because of my issues relating to foreign threat and breaking your own process. But, yeah, that's something that I think would have to be examined. And I actually recommended it to Pennsylvania. They do a red team. Basically, set this up. Do something where you're kind of doing a mock election and try to figure out weaknesses within your system and try to plug them up before 2022.
I know you host the Thought to Action podcast at londoncenter.org. And what is the topic du jour?
Well, we're going to go through this new fad of court packing. One of our distinguished fellows, Brian Griffin, and I go through and discuss this critical issue. And I think some of your audience knows this is not the first time that this has come up as an issue. This actually happened in 1937 when President Roosevelt was attempting to get around the unconstitutional New Deal things he was doing. So it was we kind of go through and discuss that again, and we walk through and just outline what the dangers are of doing that sort of thing.
You know, I have a P.S. on the voter question and yep. voting security, and it's just hit me, and that is the idea of voting by your PDA, voting yeah. on your cell phone. Where do you see vulnerabilities there, or is it a good idea?
No, highly dangerous. Anything. I know I've heard the blockchain issue. I've heard all this other stuff. It's not secure. The moment you introduce networks into a situation, what you do on your phone or pad is going to be transmitted. No matter how secure the transmission is, it has to be decrypted to a certain level regarding the headers and footers on that node. It's got to go somewhere. And the moment you release it, you lose essentially effective control of the chain of custody. That's why I recommend even now hand-marked paper ballots in person, controlled by the election officials. My concern now is the when you vote them, when you have an optical scanner vote, you know, kind of count the vote, what happens with the information there? That's a vulnerability. But no, that whole issue is, if you want to see real challenges, well, they've had several elections where that happened, and there's huge fraud. So it's something very dangerous.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, as always, thank you very much. And of course, you can follow Tony at londoncenter.org. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Rick.
You betcha. 7:45, it is the Saturday Morning Update. KT McFarland's coming up next. Stay with us. But first, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
I'm going to start with good news. The Beltway, both in Virginia and in Maryland, no construction or any accidents, so you'll be at speed. In Bethesda, on 270 Spur, northbound, there is a disabled vehicle. Left lane is blocked after Democracy Boulevard. On 695 in the district, westbound, there is construction. Only one lane is open between the 3rd Street Tunnel and South Capitol Street. And in Fairfax County, on 66 westbound, at Route 50, the Fair Oaks exit, exit 57, the on-ramp is closed. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Clouds will be on the increase as we move through the afternoon hours across the DMV, with daytime high temperatures ranging from 60 to 65 degrees. For the overnight, mostly cloudy skies. Temperatures drop down to the 40s. Winds will be out of the northwest. Tomorrow, partly cloudy. Can't rule out a chance for a few stray showers, mainly during the late afternoon hours and into the evening. Not all neighborhoods will get wet. We'll see temperatures in the 60s to lower 70s by Tuesday. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
39 degrees in the nation's capital, 746 on WMAL. This is the Saturday Morning Update. It's 7:50, and KT McFarland joins us. She is the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. And we are honored to have KT. She has had a career that includes national security posts in the Nixon, Ford, and Reagan administrations. KT, wonderful to have you as always.
Always a pleasure and an honor, Rick.
And, you know, I'm sure people would figure this out, but obviously when you were in the Trump administration, you were really initiating, because you were in the transition, you were initiating the Trump administration's reassessment of the range of national security issues, obviously Afghanistan, North Korea, China, Russia. And we're going to talk about Russia in a couple of minutes, but there's been a lot of debate this week about President Biden's announcement of pulling all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, and I wanted to get your assessment of the strategy, because there's a lot of talk on both sides about this.
Oh, I would have gotten out in December of 2001 after we had destroyed most of al-Qaeda and run them out of Afghanistan. Look, I think that for 20 years, the neocons and the Republican side and a liberal interventionist in the Democrats have led us into a very sad and sorry foreign policy and national security strategy. And one of the reasons I parted ways with the Republican establishment to support Donald Trump 5 years ago was because of this, because I think that we had focused so much on the Middle East, on oil, on terrorism, that we lost track of the main strategic threat that was rising, and that was China. And will we ever be able to catch up to where we need to be to deal with China? I don't know. Time is really running out, and I'm not optimistic that the Biden administration is going to get us there. They're right to get out of Afghanistan, but I'm not sure that they're focused as they need to be on China.
Well, it seems that there's such an emphasis on Russia, 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 and I just don't see that attention being paid to China. And, you know, the questions about the relationship of Hunter Biden and China and everything else, you know, that's a question mark. Before we move on to Russia, though, what about our priorities in the Mideast as you look at where we were and the future in the Mideast?
Well, in my wonderful book that everyone should read, because it's even more relevant today than when I wrote it a year and a half ago, because it articulates what the foreign policy for Republicans should be, is the idea that we're so focused on the Middle East because we needed their oil. And how do you deal with that? Okay, well, how do we get to the point where we don't need their oil? And that's because we could frack. And because of the United States' ability to frack oil and natural gas, we become energy independent. We no longer need to be dependent upon the Middle East, as other nations do. And it allowed us a huge freedom of movement in our national security strategy. I think that I'm really old, Rick. As you pointed out, I've been in all those administrations going back to the 1970s. The one thing I've learned about life and about national security is it's important to set priorities. You can't do everything, and you can't do everything all at the same time. And the focus that we had on the Middle East meant that we weren't focused where we needed to be on Asia. the people who are now saying, oh, we have to stay in Afghanistan forever, I guess, and fight the Taliban forever, I guess, they don't, you know, they're not the guys with the bottom line trying to figure out, well, if we do this, we can't do that. And so it's a matter of setting your priorities straight. You know, Afghanistan, we won that war in 3 months. After September 11th, we sent in U.S. Marines and Army Special Forces into Afghanistan, and in 3 months, the military came up with the most brilliant strategy to destroy al-Qaeda. And we destroyed al-Qaeda, and there were just less than 200 of them left. And instead of chasing them across the border into Pakistan, where they fled, we stuck around Afghanistan to nation build, to make Afghanistan, I guess, terrorist proof, which was never going to happen. The country doesn't want that. It's not a place that we have any strategic interest in. You know, and I think the American people are really sick and tired of borrowing money to fight wars, to prop up leaders in countries that don't matter. So the nation building, whether it was in Vietnam, whether it was in Iraq, whether it was in Afghanistan, you know, you name it, it just hasn't worked. And we used to be the country that finished the wars that other people started, World War One, World War Two. Now we get into these wars that we ourselves can't finish, and nobody wants to join us in. And that's what I guess I'm worried now, that we've gotten ourselves into the position with the Biden administration that we have definitely a strategic adversary in China, which is going to take all of our national energy and innovative spirit and creativity and finances, et cetera, to deal with. But at the same time, we now have a new crisis with Russia, and we are going to have a crisis with Iran. And Iran, Russia, China, all three together, is a very potent and powerful combination that we will have a very difficult time dealing with.
I would think a basic strategy would be not to do anything that would really encourage China, Russia, and Iran to want to work closer together against the United States. So I just don't think that's a great idea, but it strikes me that the Biden administration is sort of moving Russia, at least in that direction, to put the team together.
Yeah, you know, I used to teach nuclear weapons and conventional forces at MIT when I was doing my doctorate. And the first thing you learn in any military planning is you never want to fight a two-front war. You never want to have adversaries on all sides. And that's exactly what we've done. The whole Russia thing, Russia, Russia, Russia. You know, the 2000 election, oh, Donald Trump didn't win. It must have been the Russians that helped him. Collusion, collusion. Oh, let's have impeachment. The whole thing was a fraud, and they all knew it. The intelligence community whispered into the ears of the media. The media was thrilled to run with the Russia, Russia, Russia story because it was great for their bottom line. You know, it got them ratings. It got them, made them into rock stars. And so they pursued it, not only about the 2016 election to try to delegitimize it, but throughout the Trump administration, Russia, Russia, Russia. And now we're back to Russia, Russia, Russia. Look, Putin is a really bad guy, and he has done really bad things, and Russia is an adversary of the United States. But in the end of the game, Russia has the economy the size of Texas. It has an aging population. It has an economic model that doesn't work for its own people. It can't feed its own people despite having great some of the greatest farmlands in the world. It is not a country that is going to challenge the United States strategically in the years ahead. However, a Russia-China combination, a Sino-Soviet, a Russo-Sino alliance, which is what the United States has been dealing with since the end of World War II, trying to break those two up, we are now pushing them into each other's arms. Because by making Russia, Russia, Russia the centerpiece, the sort of boogeyman of everything, we are now in a position where the Russians and the Chinese are working together with Chinese technology, Chinese money, Russian weapons, Russian natural resources to form an alliance that is pretty formidable, not just against the United States, but in all of Asia. And that is the world that the Biden administration is leaving us. And so, again, I'm all for these sanctions against Russia. But you really want to get tough against Russia? Why don't you go after their economy? Why don't you go after their natural resources? Why don't you go after their ability to, say, have a pipeline into Europe? No, we're going to throw a couple of sanctions. That'll be really tough enough. It's not tough enough. The inability to imagine what's coming for the United States, I think, is the greatest tragedy of our day.
Hmm. And I do want to point out that chapter in your book, and I know something that you've said in the past is so striking to me, and that is, quote, "It is always easier to get into a war than to get out." And I think that's a very important point.
Well, especially as we're having trouble in the Black Sea with the Russians. Anyway, good news about everything is that after Jimmy Carter, we got Ronald Reagan. I think after Joe Biden, we're going to get a great Republican president.
Always leave it on a high note, KT. I like that. KT McFarland, the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, we're coming up on 8 o'clock. We've got the news next, then it's Garden Sense right here on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. Now, more than ever, depend on 105.9 FM WMAL, a Cumulus station.